We are in Perek Aleph Mishnah Zayin. That's where we left off. And we come to the teaching of Nitai Ha'arbeli. Again, very unusual. We encounter some very unusual names in our studies of Pirkei Avos. Yeshua ben Prachya Nitai Ha'arbeli. Again, these are the pairs that were both the Av Beis Din and the Nasi. So Nitai Ha'arbeli was the Av Beis Din in his time. Essentially the second in command in Jewish leadership. So he gives us three pieces of advice. Actually, you know, even before we do this, I want to just mention briefly a thought about Pesach Sheni. Because today is Pesach Sheni. I went to a bris this morning. I was eating my bagel with my matzah. They had matzah floating around as well. That's a good question. But Pesach Sheni, you're allowed, you know, the halachas of Pesach Sheni allowed for chametz to be eaten along with matzah, which itself is pretty interesting. I was hopeful at the bris as I made my way downstairs this morning at Rabbi Neuberger's shul. I was hopeful that they would have some matzah. And lo and behold, they had matzah going around. Maybe I'll take a slice for the road. But what's the idea of Pesach Sheni? Just on a simple level, what took place? So first of all, you know, the message of Pesach Sheni obviously is a message of second chances. And what's unique about Pesach Sheni is that it's a portion of the Torah that was created by Klal Yisrael. It was the willingness of the Jewish people to feel and to express their lack of opportunity to perform a mitzvah. And they said, Lama Nigara, why should we lose out? Now, how many of us feel, you know, that if we were pardoned for a day from, you know, from Torah and mitzvah observance, would we feel that we're losing out? I'm sure many of us would feel it's a burden off our head, at least. And again, it's not to say that we don't enjoy in the general sense Torah and mitzvahs, but there's an element of responsibility, and it comes with a degree of burden, unfortunately. We're humans, and we respond that way. So to think, here were these people, they were exempted from bringing the Karban Pesach. They had a legitimate excuse. And they came to Moshe, they said, Lama Nigra, why should we lose out? And it was such a fascinating thing that this was a parsha that was put into the Torah. They created Torah. That's how Rashi explains it, and that's how the deeper Sfarim, you know, elaborate on it, that they literally created Torah. They created a mitzvah through their ratzon, through their strong desire. Famous statement, you know, nothing stands in the way of a person's desire. This is the ultimate example where people literally were able to create Torah, they fashioned Torah through their will. So it's remarkable that in and of itself, you know, tells us something pretty remarkable about this day. It's a day of longing for something. It's a day of saying, if I failed to take advantage of something, it's not too late to catch up. You know, what's interesting is we know every month has an action associated with it. The action for the month of Nisan is speaking, right? Is Dibur. Many of the holiday Pesach literally means Pesach, a mouth which speaks. The night is a night of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? Of recounting the tale, of interacting with our family and others. So the month of Nisan is associated with speech. Right? Kabbalistically, that's what the month of Nisan is associated with. Iyar, the Sfarim say, is the month of Hirhor, of thought. The Gemara has a statement, has a discussion, is Hirhor Kedibur Dami? Right, is thought like speech? Can I fulfill? If tonight we're supposed to count, right? Yes, today is the 29th day of the Omer. Tonight we're going to count the 30th. So if I think tonight, after the proper time, if I think about the 30th day of the Omer, is that considered counting? Right? Do we view Hirhor Kedibur or not? So for most halachic things, we do not. But there is such a concept. Right? There is a relationship between thought and speech. And the way that expresses itself, what's the one month that actually has a concept of a redo of a mitzvah? It's Iyar. Iyar is, again, Iyar being the month of Hirhor, Nisan being the month of speech, so there's a relationship between the two. So yes, while, again, in many areas of halacha we do not believe that thought is equated with speech, but it's still, on some level, it expresses itself in this month that we're given a second opportunity, the Pesach Sheni, the opportunity to take advantage of a lost opportunity, if we see it as such. It stems from, again, from that attitude of Lama Nigara. Why should I lose out? Why should I be deprived of the opportunity to do this mitzvah? So it's a remarkable thing that these individuals who stepped up and, you know, demanded the right to do mitzvahs, it's certainly a very powerful message. Also, you know, what qualifies as a person who missed out on Pesach Rishon? So the Torah discusses a person who's either tamei lenefesh, as these people were. Machlokas in the Gemara, why were they tamei? Perhaps they were carrying the bones of Yosef at Tzadik. For whatever reason they were tamei. Maybe they encountered a mace mitzvah. It's a little unclear who, you know, a random dead body, who maybe a Jew, but not a little unclear where that body perhaps came from. But for whatever reason they were tamei. Or the Torah discusses the possibility that a person is derech v'choka. If he's outside of the temple area when the Karban Pesach is being brought, so he didn't have the opportunity. So Rashi says, where could this fellow be? What's considered derech rechoka? Is he on the other side of the world? Is he many miles away from the Mikdash? He could be as far as what? He could be chutz la'askupas ha'azar. He could be right on the threshold, right outside the azar, right outside the temple courtyard, and he's considered outside. And the Sfarim who develop the inner ideology behind this explain that sometimes a person can be so close but yet so far. Right? Imagine here we're calling a person deruch rechoka. This is rechoka. He's a footstep outside of the place of the mikdash, and he's called deruch rechoka. He's an outsider. He's someone who's far away. Sometimes the message is, as the Hasidic Sfarim develop, sometimes a person could, in theory, be right on the edge of holiness, but that one step out is all the difference in the world. And therefore they explain, the Kajnitz or Magid, for example, says, what's an example of someone who's derech rechoka? Right? And it may sound a little harsh to us. So many times throughout the day we have opportunity to daven, to say brachos. He says, do we stop and think what we're saying when we say baruch atah? Imagine if a great political leader or a person of spiritual significance came to visit us this afternoon. He came to sit with us, and I wanted to offer him a glass of water. Right? Again, whether it was a religious figure or even a secular figure, but a person who's been granted a position of authority, right? The President of the United States of America. So I wouldn't say to him, what would you like to drink? I would say, what would Mr. President like to drink? I would address him in the third person to show some type of, there are certain cultures throughout the world where this is practiced always when you speak to someone who's older than you. You speak in the third person. Right? But if a great Rosh Yeshiva, what can I get the Rosh Yeshiva to drink? I wouldn't say, what would you like to drink? I'd show that there's some type of disconnect that I'm not, I don't see myself as your equal. Well, yet when we talk to Hashem, we address him directly. Ata, you. Right? You. We speak directly to him. Chavetz Chaim once pointed out, there's a machlokas what the word baruch means. When I say a bracha, do I say baruch ata? What am I saying? Does baruch mean, blessed are you, God? Well, why does God need our blessing? That's how some interpret it. Others say baruch means you are the source of blessing. I'm acknowledging that you are the source, and therefore this is what I need. The Chavetz Chaim said there may be a machlokas, maybe a debate as to what the word baruch means amongst the early commentaries. But ata, everyone agrees on. You, we're saying, right? We're talking directly to God. So the Kajnitz or Magid said, when we say you, do we really feel you? Do I feel like I'm talking to someone who I can relate to? Again, a person of flesh and blood who I feel distance from, I don't even say you. And yet to God, the master of the universe, I say you? He says, that's what it means. A person can be on the threshold of the Beis HaMikdash and yet be considered derech rechoka. He's going through the motions, he's davening, he's saying the proper brachos before taking a drink, but does he realize that he's engaging in an intimate discussion with his Creator? I've been learning with a group of people on Tuesday nights, we've been learning the Sefer Chovas HaTalmidim from the Piyazetz Nerebi, which is a remarkable work. Feldheim just translated it into English. It's really very worthwhile. It's not only written for Talmidim, although he is primarily addressing a yeshiva student, but it's a book about finding oneself. And he says, sometimes when we try to talk to God, it seems very unnatural. Right? Certainly, Chassidus puts more of an emphasis on this, but it's an important concept. Even though Chavetz Chaim brings it down in his book of Halacha, the Mishnah Berurah, he mentions this idea of his bodhis, of secluding oneself and talking to God in a personal way. But it feels very awkward sometimes. So just last night, we learned, the Piyazetz Rebbe says, go outside on a clear night. Right? We can see the stars. He says, look up to the heaven and create the following image. He says, picture yourself on one side, right? Here you are on earth, on one side of the world. And you're looking up to the heavens and you say to yourself, somewhere out there, right? Maybe way out there, but somewhere out there on the other side of the universe, God is more revealed. Here where he's so concealed, out there, his presence is felt. And there are angels. And there are the souls of the righteous of earlier generations who are, sitting and basking in his presence. And say to yourself, as you so to speak, like lock eyes with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, say, I know you're out there, and I know you're interested in having a relationship with me, and allow yourself, use a technique of allowing, the natural world to just overwhelm you with its beauty, and you'll feel God's presence, he says. And he goes on to describe, he says, there's a halacha, when we say Kedusha, when we say Kadosh, 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 we raise ourselves up on our feet, we're supposed to picture ourselves being elevated through the universes. So the halacha is you're supposed to look up at that moment. When you say kadosh, 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 you're supposed to raise your eyes. That's an interesting halacha, not a lot of people are aware of it. You're supposed to look up, even for a moment, when that takes place. What's the idea? So the idea is brought in earlier, very early Kabbalistic works, that God says, this is what God says to the heavens. He says, go tell my children that at the moment they say Kedusha, and they raise their eyes to the heavens, and they, so to speak, lock eyes with me, God says, that's the moment I desire more than any other moment. Every single day, or at least whenever we have the opportunity to daven with the minyan, and you say Kedusha. Right? Mishnah Berurah records this very beautiful language, quoting from earlier Kabbalistic works, which is not, you know, his practice so often. But the Chafetz Chaim records this, that we lock eyes with Hashem at that moment, and it's like, and the way the Piyazetz Rebbe describes it, he says, you know, imagine the father and the son, right, who love each other, they lock eyes, and they see each other, and there's this loving moment. I was at someone's house last night. We had the shir at someone's home, the bris I went to today. So I said, you know, when a newborn child is brought into this world, and a new neshama comes into this world, right, and the parent looks at this child for the first time, and as the child starts to learn to focus and actually, you know, can make eye contact with the parent, and starts to smile for the first time, the parent just feels, you know, there's no words that are being exchanged, but just looking at each other in that way, that loving way, all of a sudden there's just this unbelievable feeling, and you just want to, you want to hug and kiss that child. So Hashem says in this Medrash, it says that, again, we lock eyes with Hashem. Hashem says it's the greatest pleasure we give the Jewish people, we give God, and He says, I grab onto my Kisei HaKavod. Again, this is all a mashal. God, you know, it's not physically a throne, but however we want to understand that, God says, I grab onto my throne of glory, and I kiss the image of Yaakov Avinu, which is etched onto my throne of glory. Which is Hashem's way of saying, you know, I kiss every single Jew. So, you know, imagine that moment when we relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when we lock eyes with Him, when we have that intense moment of, and the truth is, again, that's what we're supposed to experience every single time we say, Atah, right? Baruch Atah Hashem, you, right? I'm looking at you, I feel your presence. And that's part of the message of Pesach Sheni, not to be an outsider. Again, if you're even, says Rashi, even if you're on the threshold of the Beis HaMikdash, you're a step outside the Beis HaMikdash, you're Derech Rechoka, you're very far away. Because again, you're wanting to connect to God, but there's still that level of disconnect. And the message of Pesach Sheni is, you know, if you miss the opportunity to connect with God the first time, so find a way to connect with Him a second time. But let the connection be a personal one. Take that extra step to enter the Beis HaMikdash. You figure, what's the difference? You know, it's a difference of a step. But that's all the difference between being in the Mikdash and being outside the Mikdash. Being within the holiness and feeling God's presence, and being someone who sees himself again as, you know, as wanting to relate to God, but not really knowing how to make that connection.
So today we just, in the way we celebrate Pesach Sheni is just eating matzah.
Right. Well, I mean, what? Yeah. And the practical. Right. Many have a practice to eat matzah, although there's no, you know, there's still no obligation to eat matzah. But it's a minhag just to, you know, to recognize the day. But the message of the day is really one of lama nikra. Why should I lose out? To see mitzvahs as an opportunity, and if I've been denied that opportunity, then I feel like I've lost out. And again, that second message of not to see myself. So if a person was tamei nefesh or derech rechoka, if he's a little bit, his soul has become tainted, or if he feels a little distant from God, today's the day. You know what? God says there's a second chance. Reach out to me. You'll find me. You'll find my presence. You'll be able to say Ata and realize that you're talking to me, a loving Father who cares about you, and you'll lock eyes with me, and you'll have that, you know, that embrace, that intense moment that's being described. And again, we have the opportunity really every single day. We make a bracha. We say kedusha. We elevate ourselves to the heavens. But Pesach Sheni is that reawakening of this idea. All right, let's come back to Pirkei Avos now. Okay, so we're in Perek Aleph, Mishnah Zayin. And Nita Arbeli says the following statement. Harchek mishachein ra. Right, first and foremost, distance yourself from a bad neighbor. Perek Aleph, Mishnah Zayin. Harchek mishachein ra. Distance yourself from a bad neighbor. Va'al tischaber l'rasha. Do not befriend the wicked person. Va'al tisya'ish min ha'paranus. And do not show signs of despair from punishment. Okay, let's break it down. Let's take it piece by piece. First of all, you'll notice the difference between the Shachin Ra, right, and the Rasha. What's the difference between someone who's Ra and someone who's a Rasha? How do we distinguish? Which is worse? Right? You'd think the Rasha perhaps is worse. Right? And yet, by the Rasha, all it tells me is don't befriend him. I don't have to run the other direction. By the Shachin Ra, not only do I have to, right, not befriend him, but harchik, distance myself. But he's my neighbor. What, you expect me to buy a new house? What do you want from me? Yeah, okay, so if you have to put up a fence, do something. It's so severe that I can't even, you know, live in my own house. He's gonna affect me. Yes, because he's Ra. The difference between Ra and Russia, the Sfarim explain, is that Russia still has the letter Shin inside. I think we shared once in the past the idea of, by Pesach, right, by the Russia, we say, Hakeyas Shinav. So I think I shared an idea from Shlomo Karlbach, really based on Hasidic works, that, right, the idea of knock out Shinav, which literally means the teeth of the Rasha, also means knock out his shin. What does it mean, knock out his shin? Right? In the word Rasha, you see the middle letter is the letter shin. Right? Knock out the shin, the Sfarim explain, means bring out the letter shin. He's a Rasha. Yes, on the outside he's raw, he's evil, he's bad, but there's a shin, the three-pronged shin on the inside. What's the three-pronged shin? The three-pronged shin is, it represents the Avos, right? He has a connection to the Avos and the Imos. He has an internal connection. It may be very much buried inside of himself. But inside, he has that, he's rooted in that shin, that three-pronged, right, family from which we all come from. He has a connection there. So therefore, the Shachin Ra is one who's Kulo Ra. He doesn't even have the shin anymore. And therefore, you need to sometimes a person is so removed. You know, the Chafetz Chaim used to give the comparison to certain illnesses. You sometimes have a person who's terribly ill, but with tremendous effort, he can be saved. You sometimes have another person who's so ill that at this point, he can't be saved. The only thing that can happen is if you try to involve yourself with him is that you could become contaminated with that illness, assuming it's a disease that can be, you know, is contagious. So therefore, where do we put our efforts in? Unfortunately, and again, we would never like to accept this, we'd never like to label someone as raw beyond hope, but the reality is sometimes a person has put up such a, you know, such walls around himself that he's not reachable. And therefore, the only choice they have is to walk away at that point. He's raw. There's no shin anymore. The Rasha, Atis Chaber LaRasha, means what? Don't befriend him. What does that mean? It means two things. Number one, don't befriend him, but at the same time, don't distance yourself completely from him. Meaning, be careful. If I'm going to involve myself with him, I have to make sure that I'm the one who calls the shots in this friendship. I'm not the one who's trying to befriend him. If he wants to befriend me, if I can bring him closer to God in that way, if I can bring him closer to Judaism and Torah in that way, that's wonderful. Right? So again, have a relationship with him, but it has to be done in a careful way. Right? Don't run the other way. Don't be harchik from him. Don't distance yourself from him. At the same time, if I'm going to befriend him, it has to be done in a proper way. The flip side also is, you know, the other aspect of, if I'm not befriending him, so, you know, why am I not running the other way? Partially, you want to keep the Russia in check. Meaning, if I leave him be, if I abandon him completely, there's a concern that he'll cause great damage. Right? If I keep him within, if I don't distance myself, if I keep him within my eyesight, so to speak, sometimes that will keep him under control. But again, that's the more negative aspect. The more positive aspect is, well, I have to be careful in befriending him. I'm told not to run away from him because the shin is still there. The potential is still there if I'm able to find it. Okay, so that's the difference between, again, the Shachin Ra, who I run from, and the Rasha, who I carefully engage in dialogue. Okay, what about the end of the Mishnah? What's this idea of Al Tisya'ish Min HaParanus? Do not despair from punishment. So some explain it as being connected to the first part of the Mishnah. Sometimes you see the Rasha, and he's just getting away with everything. He's got it all, right? This wicked individual, for some reason, he's getting all these breaks in life. Everything seems to be going his way. And you, a person who's striving for holiness, is everything seems to not be going your way. You're struggling maybe with health, maybe with monetary issues, whatever it is. And you question God and you wonder, I don't understand. You know, the Russia is having his day, while I, the righteous individual, am struggling. How could that be? So the Mishnah concludes, Al tisya'ish min haparanus. Right? Do not despair, do not give up hope that what? That there's going to be judgment passed against him. Don't think that this guy is going to get away with it. Yes, things seem to be going his way for the, you know, in the short run, but Al Tisya'ish, don't despair. God has a plan. If it looks in the short run that the Rasha is celebrating and living the life of joy and great pleasure, while you, the righteous individual, are suffering, Al Tisya'ish. Right? Don't be so quick to assume that this guy is going to get away with it. Hashem has his ways of working things out. That's one way of learning the connection between this, you know, the closing statement of the Mishnah and the earlier comments. Others point to the following. Some say it's a message of hope. We'll describe it independently as not necessarily being connected to the first two statements, but Rashi gives two explanations of what it means, and in his second explanation he says, Al tisya'ish min haparanus, do not despair if things don't go your way. Meaning what? Very often things will turn, meaning, again, the first way we were learning it is that the Rasha who's getting away with things, he'll get his punishments. But Rashi flips it into a more positive light. If things are not going your way, don't despair. Don't be broken from the difficulties that we encounter in our own life. And the Chassam Sofer and others expounded on this idea by sharing the thought that, you know, sometimes the thing that we initially perceive as so tragic, as so terrible, in fact leads to a great salvation. Things that, you know, we never would have wished upon ourselves, we see that over time, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. I'm teaching now in school, we're learning Parshas Vayeshev. Yosef, we just learned the scene where Yosef is sold by his brothers. According to many, according to others, he's not actually sold by his brothers. Okay, it's very interesting. You read the Pesukim carefully and you learn the classic Rishonim on it. Very, very interesting approach. Who actually sold Yosef? Did the brothers sell him? Who did they sell him to? Yishmaelim, Midyanim. Right, a lot of handling going on. Poor Yosef's caught in the middle of it. And the Torah describes that the Yishmaelim caravan, this caravan of Ishmaelites who are coming to him, are carrying a variety of sweet-smelling spices. Mentions it in passing. So Rashi asks, you know, why bother sharing that with us? Why do I care what the Yishmaelim were carrying with them? I mean, it doesn't say that it was in any way involved in the sale. What's the point of sharing with me that they're carrying Nechos and Tsari, right, which Rashi, you know, identifies as pleasant-smelling spices? So he says, normally the Yishmaelim were carrying petroleum and resin. Normally they're carrying things, transporting things that don't smell very good. Hashem wanted this tzaddik, Yosef HaTzaddik, as on his way down to Mitzrayim, to have a sweet-smelling ride. You think about it, it's almost absurd, right? We're taking you hostage, right? You're going to be stripped from your father's home. You're being sold by your own brothers. Can you imagine such a horrific moment in the life of Yosef HaTzaddik? Right? But as you're being taken into captivity, we're going to fly you first class. As you're being taken hostage by, you know, some terrorist, we're going to let you sit in the first class of the plane. Thank you very much. I was happy in coach, you know, without the terrorists. That would have been fine. What's the message? The message is that, yes, Yosef, you're about to endure a very difficult stage of your existence, but there's a light at the end of the tunnel. And if you're looking carefully, from the beginning, God says, I'm with you. And I may be there in a very subtle way, and it may seem inconsequential, given the larger picture of what's about to happen to you, but relax. There's a message of hope there. From the start, Hashem wants to say, you know, I'm sending you, and it may be a very small comfort, it may not offer very much, but if you relax, if you give it time, you'll see that your captivity will lead to, yes, even worse things, the Jewish people being slaves in Mitzrayim. But that will set the stage for the nation to be born and for the Torah to be given. So, you know, that sweet-smelling spice, which, again, that smell that, you know, that dissipates so quickly, but it's a sign that God's there. There's a Rav, Rav Benjamin Blech, well-known Rav, he's a teacher in YU for many years, written many books on Judaism. So in 2005, he was invited, somehow, through all of his... He was involved, I know, in Kirov, in Russia, back in the day. And somehow, he's a very well-connected rabbinic speaker. And somehow, he befriended certain non-Jewish people. Eventually, the bottom line is, in 2005, he was invited with a couple other rabbis to bless the Pope and to visit the Vatican. And he did. He bestowed his blessings on the Pope, and he visited the Vatican. Now, we know that there are many great Jewish, what they would consider, you know, antiques, artifacts for them. But it's our living Torah, which is held in captivity in the Vatican. So he went to many rabbis, many other rabbis, prominent rabbis at the time, and asked, you know, if I have a chance to get my hand on some manuscripts of early, you know, authorities, I can catch a glimpse of something. What should I look for? If they put a handwritten copy of the earliest edition, known edition of the Rambam in my hand, so what should I look at? You know, there are many passages in the Rambam where people debate different textual amendments that have been made throughout history. So if I can get my hand on it, what should I look for? And pretty much, a lot of the rabbis told them, check out, one of the most important things that everyone wanted them to check out, was a Rambam on the laws of marriage. Hilchos Ishus, Perak Aleph, Halacha Beis, where there's a great debate as to whether the Rambam holds that, you know, the Mishnah, opening Mishnah, Maseches Kedushin, says you can be Mekadesh a woman in three ways. Right, with money, with a document, or with an act of intimacy for the purposes of Kedushin. So many versions of the Rambam say that Kesef is only Durabaran. And some say it's Duraisa. It's Min HaTorah. So all the rabbis wanted to know, you know, what does the Rambam really hold? If you get your hand on a manuscript of the Rambam, check that out, see what the Rambam... Okay, this is what all the great Rosh Yeshivas... And he went all around, he went to YU, went to Lakewood, he traveled to Eretz Yisrael. He asked a lot of people, what should I look at? And everyone said, this is the Rambam to look at. Fine, he gets his opportunity, comes to the Vatican. And he's being, you know, shown, I don't know what the arrangement, what the setup is over there. He's told he's going to have the opportunity to see some things, some manuscripts. He's very excited. Unfortunately, the manuscripts were locked up in display cases. So they say, oh, we want to show you, you know, a very early edition, you know, an early edition of Maimonides. Okay, that's great, but can I leave through? No, it's, you know, you can't touch it. Okay, he comes over to the display case, and he's looking at this edition of the Rambam, and the Rambam is open to that halacha. Randomly, it's open to Hilchos Ishus, Perak Aleph. And he sits there and he checks it out. He's so excited. And he's thinking to himself, here, the Rambam is being held in captivity. It's Yosef HaTzadik. He's held in captivity. Right? And yet, there's still God sends a sign that, relax, I'll give you what you need for now, and when the time comes, you'll get the whole thing. He goes to the next case, another edition of the Rambam. This one happens to be open to the laws of Kinyanim, the laws of acquisitions. And in there, it's open to a passage where the Rambam describes, based on the Gemara, that Re'iyah is not a Kinyan. That seeing something is not an acquisition. And he took it as a sign that it wasn't enough that he had the opportunity to just see these manuscripts. He needs to, it's a message from God, he needs to work harder, right, to recapture these manuscripts and to try to further befriend these individuals to hopefully, one day they'll grant full access. Happens to be, I think I don't know the details, but I know at some point some of these manuscripts of the Rambam were sent to Israel. I think four of them were sent to Israel through this relationship that he had developed. But again, he saw that as a sign, and the signs are always there. The signs are there for the person who's looking for it. And that's the message of Mishnah Zayin. Al tisyayish min haparanus. Don't despair when things don't go your way. When Yosef HaTzadik's in captivity, but there's a sweet-smelling spice. Right? And eventually that sweet-smelling spice will lead to much greater things. The Rambam's held in captivity. The Kalim of the Mishkan, of the Mikdash, are held in the Vatican. But you know what? Eventually, things will work out in a way that's good for us. Okay, so that's the idea. Don't despair. Don't be so quick to assume that God doesn't have a plan. There's always a plan. Okay, let's take a look at Mishnah Ches. Let's go on to the next Mishnah. We mentioned it last week in passing. I told the story of the square Rebbe. I'll just repeat it very quickly for those who aren't here. But the Mishnah says, Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach kiblu mehem. Yehuda ben Tabai and Shimon ben Shetach were the next in line to receive the Mesorah. Yehuda ben Tabai Omer. Al tas asmecha ka'orchei hadayanim. Do not make yourself like a lawyer. It's talking to someone who's serving as a judge. If you're the judge, be careful that you're not like a lawyer. What does that mean? Do not give information that's going to lead or incline the whether it's a jury. We don't obviously have a jury in our Beis Din, but don't give away information that's going to allow the people, the Baalei Din, the people on trial, to manipulate the system. Be very careful that you, as the judge, maintain a certain level of distance from those who are being judged. And that's what it goes on to explain. Keshayu bali hadin omdim lefanecha, when those who are on trial stand before you, yuhyu beinecha kirisham, view them as wicked. See them equally as wicked. Ukeshneftar milefanecha, and when they leave from before you, yuhyu beinecha kazakan, you should see them both equally innocent. Keshakiblu alayim asadin, assuming that they've accepted your judgment. So what does it mean? So these two fellows stand before you, and you recognize one of them as being a very well-respected, righteous individual in the town, and this other person is someone who's had some trouble in the past. How do I view them? And they're fighting over $100. So you're obviously going to be inclined towards the one who has a reputation of being an upstanding citizen, a righteous individual, and yet the Mishnah tells us, no, you have to see them equally guilty. Don't assume that either one is more correct. And when they leave, let's assume that the righteous individual is the one who is found to be correct in this court case. So now you see that other fellow on the street the next day. Don't see him as someone who's guilty, right? He's paid his dues. Kishakimlu alayim asadin. He's accepted the judgment. He's paid his fine. He's respected the court system. And therefore we respect him. We give him a fresh chance. Pesach Shina. We give him another chance to start over. We don't view him as guilty. So we shared last week. I'll just repeat it very quickly because it was a worthwhile story. The Square Rebbe, the previous Square Rebbe, who passed away in the 1960s, when he was a young boy, he was talking to his cousin. And they were debating whether it's better to be a Rav or to be a Rebbe. Right? To be a Hasidic Rebbe or to be a Rav, a Posek, a Halachist. So his little cousin said to him, he said, I think it's better to be a Rebbe. He says, why is it better to be a Rebbe? He says, because a Rebbe has the letter Yud in it. Right? And they're speaking Yiddish, a Yid. It has a Yid in it. So it has a stronger connection to the Jewish people. A Rav is just Reish Bet. A Rebbe has a Yud in it. So this guy Rebbe, as a little boy, went on to become a leader of a Hasidic Rebbe, a very great one, for that matter. So he said to his cousin, as a little boy, he says, I agree with you, a Rebbe is better than a Rav, but I have a different reason. He said, it's based on this Mishnah. He says, a Rav, a person who sits on a Beis Din, has to spend a few moments, or maybe an hour, whatever it is, as long as the court case is taking place, how does he view his fellow Jews? He views them as Rishon. He says, I can never do that. He said, I can never, even momentarily, yes, at the end I'm going to see them both as innocent, but the thought of viewing a fellow Jew as a Rasha pains me too much. And that's why I'd rather be a Hasidic Rebbe who's able to give, play the role of one who encourages, more so than the one who has to be critical even momentarily. That's the idea of not to see one's fellow Jew as a Rasha. It happens to be, I'll just share two other quick interesting points about this Mishnah. You know, there's a Gemara that says that Devora, right, the very righteous Devora, who was a shofetet, she used to sit and judge. So it says that in her righteousness, she would sit under a palm tree. Right? Why would she sit under a palm tree? So the Gemara says in Maseches Megillah, because a palm tree is a very tall tree, and that way it was in an open area, and there wouldn't be a concern of yichud. And she shouldn't be secluded with the men she was judging. So the question that some ask is, hold on a second, the halacha is that a woman can't be alone with another man who's prohibited to her, one-on-one. But if there are two men in the room, it's permitted. The halacha says that two women, and certainly if there's more. So if she's judging, presumably there are two men standing before her, why does she need to be? Okay, so you want to say it's an extra stringency she took upon herself. You could say it's highlighting, you know, that extra sensitivity that she had. Okay, could be. But some explain based on the following. At the moment that she is judging, how does she need to view the men standing before her? As wicked. The halacha is, if there are people who have a track record of being immoral people, so it could be, you know, 20 men in one woman. Right? But if they're immoral men, we're still concerned that something inappropriate might take place. And therefore, the laws of Yichud would not allow such a thing. So therefore, that explains the Gemara. Why was she, again, if she's with multiple men under this tree, why does she need to be, why does it need to be in a public place, that there shouldn't be a concern of any improper relationship? Because again, she has to view them temporarily as wicked. Further interesting halacha that perhaps comes out from this Mishnah, again, none of us, I don't think any of us are planning on sitting on a beis din anytime soon, but it's interesting, there is a halacha that the Shach brings down on the laws of judging. He quotes from the Sefer Chassidim. He says that, the Sefer Chassidim says that when a judge is sitting on a beis din, he shouldn't stare at the person on trial. He shouldn't stand at the Baal Edin who are standing before him. Why is that? So some explain, it's this idea. The halacha is, there's a Gemara that says you're not supposed to stare at a wicked person. Right? I'm always careful, you know, when they flash pictures, even on a television, of, you know, they're playing a clip of Hitler, Yimach Shemo, or Osama bin Laden, Yimach Shemo. Right? So when you look at a negative person, you know, a person's face has a tzel melokim, you look at a tzaddik, you look at a righteous individual, so you draw from them. You look at a negative person, also you draw from their negative, even without interacting. Right? Just by making eye contact, so to speak, with them. So the same idea is true here. When you're judging, the people who you're judging have to temporarily be viewed as what? As guilty. As wicked, as Rishon, the Mishnah says. And therefore the practice was not to look at them. And this also explains the idea that the judges would often sit wrapped in a talus when they would judge. And some even had the practice, just like a talus, you know, sometimes it's pulled over one's head. Right? Again, you have to obviously look to see who is standing before you, but not to stare at the face of a person who has the status of wicked, even if the person's not truly wicked, the fact that, I guess, he got himself involved in this type of situation, the fact that he even needs to come to court, obviously says something maybe a little bit about his character, and therefore, temporarily, he's viewed as wicked. So just a couple interesting halachos that come out of our Mishnah. Okay, let's go on to the next Mishnah, Shimon ben Shetach. Mishnah says, Shimon ben Shetach Omer, have a mar belachor se'edim. Again, many of these halachos are speaking specifically to judges, but of course, as we pointed out in the first year, Pirkei Avos is for every Jew, and we're all challenged to be judges, whether we like it or not, in a variety of ways. So therefore, we can apply it to ourselves as well. He says, have a mar belachor se'edim. Check the witnesses carefully. And be careful with your words, lest you, again, lead the witnesses to lie. Okay, again, on a practical level, it's speaking to judges. But I saw the Lubavitcher Rebbe had a very striking insight on check the witnesses carefully. The Gemara says, Maseches Tanis, that a person sometimes thinks that, you know, he'll get away with certain things. Again, this idea of the Russia sometimes gets away with certain things. It's done in the privacy of my own home. No one knows about it. A person can sometimes have very negative behavior that he does in private, and he thinks, at least, you know, he convinces himself that I'm never going to get caught for this. The Gemara says that when a person is called to judgment at the end of his life, so Hashem brings the testimony even in his own home. The walls of his home will testify against him. The articles of his own home will testify against him. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, "Have a marbe lachor se'edim." Check the witnesses carefully means what? Lubavitcher Rebbe says, we have to be careful about what we bring into our own home. If we're going to bring certain things into our home, and again, home could be our physical home, home could be our life, right? But all of the things that we engage in, all the activities we engage in, all of the possessions that we, you know, we acquire for ourselves, what?
Internet.
Right, the internet, which has, you know, obviously many advantages, but you know, you don't have to think too hard to figure out what the dangers of the internet are. And unfortunately, the Jewish community at large, you know, I saw a sign just today that Rabbi Twersky is speaking next Monday night, I think, at Beth Abraham, about the challenges of technology and, you know, and how it's changed how adolescents interact with friends and certain other dangers of, you know, there's constantly articles and new studies being, you know, being drafted to show the dangers of the internet and how it's made so many things which were, you know, are harmful to a good Jewish neshama so accessible, right? So the Mishnah is warning us, have a marba lachor se'edim. If you're going to bring something into your life, if you're going to engage in certain activities, or you're going to acquire certain things, which again can be beneficial if used properly, be careful, right? Well, Rav Trevi said, check them well, because those same things that you're bringing into your life, right, the things you associate with, whether it's again people or things or whatever it is, whatever we associate with, those will all be called to testimony at the end of our lives. And therefore, hopefully, we're going to want to show that our home is filled with many positive things, right, and not negative things. Okay, it's certainly a fitting message for those of us even who are not judges per se. All right, let's go on to Mishnah Yud. Shmaya v'Avtalion. Now, this next pair, Shmaya v'Avtalion, are fascinating individuals because the Mefarshim point out that they were Gerim. Again, we're talking about the Nasi and the Av Beis Din, the two, arguably the two greatest, you know, Jews of their time. And they were both converts to Judaism. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, in his parish on Pirkei Avos, Emes Liakov, points out that this is really something that distinguishes Judaism from other religions of the world. If a person was born Jewish and decided one day to abandon his Judaism, obviously we don't believe in converting out of Judaism, but let's say he chose to practice another religion, right? So in those other religions, he would not be able to reach the highest ranks of society. A Jew could not become the Pope. It just would never happen. And yet here, we have someone who converted to Judaism and was able to become the leader of the Jewish people. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky speaks very strongly. He says, there are those who claim that Judaism holds itself to be an elitist religion. And they say, you know, we're not receptive to people who want to join us. It's not true at all. We don't believe in missionary work. We don't believe in begging people to come join us. We're comfortable enough with our religion. When I was in high school, I had the privilege once in a while, it was either once a week or twice a week, Rav Shalom Kamenetsky, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's grandson, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky's son from the Philadelphia Yeshiva, which is right next door to our high school, used to come once a week to give us a special Gemara Shir. So I remember one time he was telling us that he had just come, he came and he was smiling, he said, you know, some missionaries just came knocking on my door. Imagine knocking on the door of, you know, the future Rosh Yeshiva, the Philadelphia Yeshiva, as if they're going to convince him. So he said to them, you know, probably, you know, somewhat cynically, but politely, he said, to be honest, I'm not really interested in buying a religion that has to be sold door to door. You know, how good can your product be if you have to, you know, if it's really that good, people will be coming running to you to purchase it. So, you know, the idea of Judaism being a religion where we don't do missionary work is certainly something, because we believe very strongly that our Torah is a Torah SMS, and I don't need to force it on you. At the same time, if a person wants to join, if Shmaya v'Avtalion want to convert to Judaism, and they want to be diligent in their Torah study, and they want to reach the highest rank in their time possible, to become the Nasi and the Av Beis Din, the leaders of the Jewish people, then we're certainly open to that. And therefore, Yaakov Kamenetsky, you know, challenges those who claim that it's not possible. This is the ultimate challenge for those who say that Judaism is an elitist religion. Right? Yes, we hold ourselves to a high standard, but if you're willing to operate by those standards, we're more than welcome to invite you into our lives. Okay, so Shmaya said the following. Let's see if we can maybe understand his statement with regard to his life's experience. He says, "Ahav es hamalacha usnas harabanus ba'al tizvah delirishus." He says, love the work, despise the power, the position of honor that sometimes comes with hard work, and do not become overly familiar with government. That's Pashup Shad in the Mishnah. Love work, despise the honor, and don't become overly involved in politics. Okay, what's the idea? So first of all, again, we're talking about Shmaya, someone who, first of all, he loved the work. Right? We're talking about someone who, again, he wasn't born into it. Wasn't born into a great family of Torah scholars. He was born a non-Jew. And he saw the truth of Torah, and he worked on himself. And he developed himself. And he rose to, like we said, to the highest ranks. And yet his message is, that's not what it's about. Don't think I joined Judaism because of the honor that it potentially offered me. Right? Through the hard work. Yes, I worked hard. Yes, I did climb the ranks. But snas rabbanus. That's not what it's all about. That's not what, you know, made me so proud to be a part of this people. Right? The Kotzker Rebbe pointed out, it actually connects to this week's Parsha. Just share two more thoughts, then we'll call it a day. Right? In this week's Parsha, in B'chukosai Teilechu, Rashi says, if you walk in my ways, Rashi says that it means that a person should be Amil B'Torah. One should study hard in Torah. One should work hard in Torah. So the Kotzker Rebbe said, Ahavas Malacha, love the work of Torah, Usnas Rabbanus. Right? But despise the honor that comes with it. What does that mean? You know, again, a person may choose a life of Torah because of the certain, there is a certain prestige that comes with one who's diligent and dedicated to Torah. Right? And yes, it's hard work and you deserve that type of reward. At the same time, that's not what it's about. Right? We didn't choose Torah. We don't work hard in Torah just for the, you know, for the perks. Yes, those things are all going to come. All the reward and all the pleasure that comes with a life of Torah. Right? But we should learn to love the process as well. To love the work. To enjoy the, like we said, yeah.
It's so easy today to go out and buy yourself a smicha. You go online, you get your smicha, you get your degree. Because, but that's not, and it's retarded. That's
right.
Not what it's about. The youth today want everything automatic and instantaneous.
Right.
You have to put your staff
right.
Work in order to get it.
Right, be willing to work hard. And that's, you know, we always talk about, when we talk about Torah study, we always talk about amelus v'Torah. To be amel means, you know, backbreaking labor. It's hard work. No one's going to tell you it's easy. But if a person's willing to work, the reward will come in time. But don't make it about the reward. You're cheapening the Torah, right? You're selling the Torah short if you do it in that way. And lastly, his statement, "Al tizvad de l'reshus." What does it mean, "Al tizvad de l'reshus"? Again, the simple explanation is: don't become overly involved in government, right? It has certain pitfalls. Yosef HaTzadik, we know, dies before all the other brothers because he was the one who was most involved in government. He was involved in politics. It certainly takes its toll on a person. Mordechai HaTzadik lost some of his prestige. At the end of Megillas Esther, he's described as being found favorable by most of the Jews. Not all of the Jews, after everything he did. Some said, no, it would have been better if he involved himself less in politics. He was saving Klal Yisrael. You're going to criticize him? And yet there were still some who felt that, you know, he could have had a greater impact if he stayed in the world of Torah study. Okay, obviously, he did what he needed to do. But this is there's a certain danger that comes with a person who involves himself in political activity. Okay, we'll pick up, I guess, next time. There's another shot in this Mishnah that I want to share, which is Al tizvad de l'reshus. Reshus can mean permitted things. Mm-hmm. Don't become overly involved in permitted things. And we'll talk about maybe next week the Hasidic approach, how in Judaism we don't believe in a neutral zone. Everything is either going to be a positive experience or a negative experience. There's nothing that's just permitted, but won't affect me in any way. Okay? Everyone have a great day. Thank you for coming.
I just have a
see you next week. Yeah, please.